pianist Hélène Grimaud is a brilliant, distinctive, and direct artist who will take you outside of time to another world if you let her. And she will be with us in Kalamazoo on Thursday, April 16th in a Piano Masters recital presented by the Gilmore. It is a great pleasure to speak with you, Hélène.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Now, you were supposed to have performed here last September, but you had to cancel the concert. I wondered if you could tell us what was the ailment you had, and are you fully recovered?
Yes, yes, I am. I have been playing nonstop since the beginning of November. So I'm happy to report that everything is fine. But no, I injured myself in a very silly way, and I was lucky that it was only a matter of 3 or 4 weeks before I was able to resume what I was supposed to be doing. And I'm certainly delighted that we found a replacement date for the Kalamazoo recital.
Me too. It is something we are really, really looking forward to. I did notice your concert schedule looks very healthy. When you arrive in Kalamazoo, you will have played in Los Angeles at the Walt Disney Concert Hall, a very new modern facility. And here in Kalamazoo, it's an old high school auditorium from a sort of a golden age. Yasha Heifetz played there. I wondered, how do you introduce yourself to a new instrument and a new hall? That's part of being a professional artist and a professional pianist.
Absolutely, and it's so important because, of course, the instrument is supposed to be an extension of yourself, and to make it that, you have to spend time with it. It's not, I mean, sometimes it happens automatically if you're a good match with the instrument and the instrument immediately responds to your way of taking the sound and you like the way it feels and the way it sounds, then you can be like, you know, a fish in water immediately. But of course, when that's not the case, then you need time to get to know the instrument and to feel the resonance or the lack thereof in the hall. All of these are essential factors, which of course affect a performance tremendously. So it's important to take time and to, you know, go and select the instrument if there is a choice, or to take time to meet the technician, the person in charge of the instrument, and to work with them. So this is all definitely part of the process. Yeah.
We have a tendency as humans to give personalities to things, to anthropomorphize instruments. I wondered if you do kind of classify one piano as a grand old lady or another one as a young firebrand type of instrument.
Well, yeah, sometimes it happens. It depends the relationship you create to the concert grand. But yeah, sometimes, you know, and different adjectives to describe the quality of sound or the character of the tone or the way that the mechanic is reacting. You know, sometimes colleagues speak of race car, you know, Ferrari-like, when the instrument is very, very quick to react and has this, you know, this power. So yeah, there are many different ways of relating to an instrument and therefore describing it. And actually, it's funny that you should say talk about a grand old lady, because there is one such instrument at the Philharmonie in Cologne. I remember when one of the last times that I was trying pianos there, I like both instruments there very much, and depending on what I'm there to play, whether it's with orchestra or recital, and if with orchestra, then what repertoire, I would say I've you know, chosen one 60% of the time, the other one 40% of the time. But the technician was telling me that a couple of colleagues had referred to the older instrument as grande old dame, which is very, very funny. So that one hadn't occurred to me yet, though, because I tend to think of a concert grand as a male presence somehow.
Well, I was prompted to ask the question because I was listening to your Bach recording and the Preludes and Fugues. Even in the recording, I could hear you manipulating your touch at the instrument and asking it to do so much more than I usually hear in piano recordings, such a wide spectrum of tone and colors. And it just seemed to me that relationship between you and the instrument must be so crucial.
Well, that's right. And actually, if you think about it, you know, sometimes people think of a piano as, you know, a piano is a piano is a piano. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. And, you know, perhaps the instrument is less fragile than a Stradivarius, although, frankly, I in fact doubt it. I think that when you see pianos going downhill within the course of 10 years, it's pretty obvious that pianos require a very special kind of care in the way that they're storaged and voiced. They should ideally be voiced on stage, not in a storage room below the stage or to the side of the stage. That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. The piano also has ideally to live in the space where it's going to be played most of the time, because otherwise they tend to somehow shrink and wrinkle like an old apple. So there are, you know, many precautions to be taken. And if you think about it, you know, imagine a great violinist showing up, any great violinist, and you tell them, wonderful to have you here, but we're going to take your violin away and we're going to ask you to play your, you know, Bach partitas recital on this sort of high school level instrument or conservatory level instrument. Well, they would just laugh at you. I mean, you would have absolutely no chance. And unfortunately, that's often what's expected of pianists, you know. So it's not always just that you get someplace and you're dealing with simply an instrument that you don't know, that you have to get to know and find a way to get the best out of in just a few hours. And that's even generous because normally you don't even have a few hours on stage with it. So, but it's also that, you know, sometimes the instrument isn't just not what it should be. So it's an extra challenge, but some would say that it's a small price to pay for the privilege of being a pianist and having the independence that we have on many other levels.
My sister is also a pianist, and she has a best friend who is a piano technician, and it's actually a very rewarding relationship they have because she's come to understand so much more about the instrument and how to take care of it. I imagine you might have a friend who is also a piano technician too.
Yes, I'm lucky to count quite a few as friends, and sometimes I've actually toyed with the idea of just taking, you know, a little time out of the schedule and spending a few days with one of them and just, you know, learning more myself so that I can perhaps do some things on my own.
You could have your own toolkit. Yes.
There you go.
I understand how pianists practice and take care of their physicality. I think you have a special creative voice, and I wondered how you take care of your muse. Can you wear it out? Do you have to replenish it?
Oh, I think it's absolutely possible to wear it out. I think that you have to be very vigilant. Like anything precious, you have to take care of it. You can't take it for granted. I mean, for me, there are different ways of doing it. If I'm, for example, playing a piece which is familiar to me, which I've played a lot and spent a lot of time living with, I don't really like to do it on what's already acquired. So I like to take it apart, dismantle it, and make new decisions. They may not be new decisions from a point of view of interpretation, but at least make decisions anew, or just, you know, just re-choose certain options, conceptual options. And so I think that's very important, so that you're not just, again, just showing up and doing what you're doing just because that's what you did the last time. So that's, you know, one way of keeping it fresh. And, of course, another aspect is, as you said, you know, to just also find ways to resource yourself. I mean, just to take time to refresh your own mind and soul and heart in your relationship to the instrument, to the piece itself, to the music, sometimes to the profession at large. And that requires a certain amount of, you know, wisdom, knowing how to time yourself and knowing how to make the most of the breaks that you do have so that you, you know, can't wait to get back out there. I mean, of course, that's one of the tremendous strengths of the material we are blessed to work with day in and day out, is that, you know, so many of these pieces, especially in the case of being a pianist, so much of this repertoire is so fantastic and has so much depth to it that it's always larger than the interpreter. So it's always going to be showing you new sides of itself, new aspects. You're always going to be discovering new things, and that's certainly what I think keeps us at this, you know, at just spending decades in the company of certain works and revisiting them on a regular basis.
I would think they start to speak back to you. It becomes more of a dialogue with the composer and yourself. So you don't have to do all the work.
Well, that's absolutely true what you're saying, because in fact, sometimes pieces develop a life of their own, even within yourself. So let's say you've played it a lot and then you give it some rest for a while. Well, when you go back to it, you realize how much the piece has grown within you, even when you weren't actively engaged with it. So they do. They bring their own dynamic into the mix, for sure.
The first part of your program is constructed of smaller pieces that have a character of some sort or other related to water. And the first two pieces, right away, you take us into a very unfamiliar world with two composers who didn't necessarily need to use a tonal language in their works, Luciano Berio and Takemitsu. I've read that you design programs so that the pieces talk to each other and you can bring out these things. Is that how this came about?
Very much so. I mean, okay, I try to, and it's a very subjective take on things. So, you know, just because this particular association and juxtaposition of pieces is speaking to me, of course, does not mean that it's going to have a universal appeal. But it's, it's certainly the place to start, because you have to be utterly convinced of what you're doing to begin with before you can hope to accomplish anything on that stage. But it is a very, very personal choice at the end of the day, yes.
I love the fact that you're going to disorient me before I get to the familiar chords of Fauré's Barcarolle and the Ravel. It's going to take me a little out of my normal comfort zone.
Well, and those particular pieces are so... they're so evocative and so tender, and they create such a sense of space within the sound and within the harmonies, or the rubbing of harmonies, as the case may be. So they have a very special quality of meditation. I think it's actually a very nice way to enter the program let's say as discreetly as possible.
The Fauré is a barcarolle, a gondola song. The Ravel is a fountain, the play of water. I don't know the Albéniz piece. Is that a vocal song originally?
No, it isn't. It's very much a piano piece from Iberia, and it has a very, very wonderful, very sensual and beautiful rhythmical elements to it. It's perhaps the most material piece of all of them. It's the one where you can really feel the not only the water but the earth and the people living in that area. But it's nevertheless. For me, it definitely has its place in the program. But that's also the reason, actually, why it is situated the way that it is between the Ravel and the Liszt. So I'm extremely fond of the piece, so I hope you will be too.
Oh, well, I know I will, especially when you've deliberately placed it in a picture with special frames around it to make the picture stand out even more. After your program's first half, filled with images of water, you're coming back in the second half with one work, a sonata by Johannes Brahms. If the Brahms Sonata No. 2 were to represent an element, fire, water, air, or earth, what do you think it would be?
It's actually interesting, because in the beginning I wanted to do a program that would be all water pieces in a very obvious way. There are a few reasons why these water reflections, if you will, evolved the way that they did over the last year, and ultimately leading me to this particular program. But at the end, this selection of music is not obviously not meant to be bibliographical juxtaposition of all pieces for piano ever to, you know, have a title having to do with the theme of water. I mean, obviously, otherwise there would be quite a few additional works by Liszt, by Ravel, and Debussy, to name only the most obvious. But what I found as I was working through these pieces and many more, trying to decide which ones to keep, it occurred to me that most of the 20th century pieces, okay, end of the 19th as well, seem to focus more on the colorful, the decorative, the atmospheric, the poetic nature of water. I mean, you're going to say maybe that's enough, but I felt somehow that there was a need to complete the range of expressive possibilities, something to do with, you know, return to the source. No pun intended. One of the founding, for me, one of the founding precepts of the German Romantic movement was well, not only that all disciplines of our existence take root in a global intuition, but more relevantly in this case, that nature is the ultimate muse and that it's an inextinguishable source of inspiration. And so ultimately this program is a subjective take on this phenomenon. And I felt very strongly that Brahms' Second Sonata, with those tempestuous sounds and textures, really reminiscent of the violence that the elements can unleash on our world, that was somehow a fitting conclusion to the program. And it's something which is quite wild and rangy in its expressive spectrum, and it's something very, very strong, and also very rare, actually, amongst the things that Brahms has left us. So that's, you know, the story of how this program came together. You know, Da Vinci was obsessed with water. He found it to be full of paradox and the driving force of all nature, sweet and strong and deadly. And the deadly dimension was sorely missing from the first half. And so that's where Brahms came to find its place there.
Yes, yes, we have controlled water sources in the first half, but we're very far from the safety of shore, and we have to contend with the raw element in this sonata. Which is funny, because I was thinking, well, it's Brahms who is so good at creating a foundation, so he's more of an earth kind of element. But no.
No, you're right. He normally is, though. He absolutely normally is. But in this case, you know, Lord of the Sky, the rain god, Thunderbolt as a weapon, and the great presiding deity of the universe and its aerial phenomena and personification of the laws of nature. So I thought, well, that's how I've always thought of this second sonata, and that's why it needs to be there.
Well, finally, people who know you will want to come up and talk to you about the wolves of Michigan. We have the gray wolf in Michigan, about 600 to 700 animals right now. And
Yes. Very
recently, they stopped new legislation that would allow hunting. And so that was a good thing to protect the animals. But I thought I would ask you to tell listeners how they can take action or be a part of your effort to conserve their habitat and help educate people about wolves if they had a chance. What can they do?
There are many things you can do. I think you have to vote with your dollars, with what you choose to spend your money on as a consumer. I think you have to voice your concerns as a citizen in the political choices that you make. Support the people that support what's important to you, and that should be what's good for this planet and for human generations to come. In the case of wolves, this decision to delist is absolutely premature. I mean, I find it to be absolutely wrong and not based in science, mm-hmm. actually. So this whole debate about, wolves taking down too many prey and that affecting the environment in a negative way is absolute nonsense, because as we know by now, predators and prey control their own numbers. And it's something which, where very little human intervention is needed. But of course, to protect a wide-ranging predator such as the wolf, you also need to protect its habitat. That's primordial. And so all of these things are essential. But there are fortunately a lot of wonderful organizations, especially in the United States, which do a great job at teaching environmental education and teaching about the wolf and its role as a top predator in the environment, as an engineer of biodiversity, and how interconnected all things in nature are, and why it's so important to preserve them from the top down. So I think that, fortunately, most of America is pretty enlightened about this. But there's always work to do, and again, as we see with this most recent attempt, it's always a hot subject.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you again so much for your thoughts, and I can't wait for your program here in Kalamazoo.
Well, thank you very much. That's very, very kind. I'm really, really so looking forward, and thank you for your time today and for our conversation.